Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 221 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And I'm going to call this podcast the Trauma Podcast. It's basically a podcast for people that are taking the surgery shelf or the emergency medicine shelf. I'll try to make this short and sweet, so let's just get right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient was in a motor vehicle accident? And then this patient is having like a lot of like shortness of breath. And they tell you that on physical exam, you notice subcutaneous emphysema. And then, so like, you know, like a crunchy appearance to the person's skin. And then they tell you that, oh, this person, they get a chest x-ray or they get a chest CT and they see dark linear lines outlining the tracheobronchial tree. If you see that, what do you want to think about on an exam? I would really hope you're thinking about some kind of rupture of the bronchus or rupture of the trachea. This thing has a very classic presentation on MBME exams, and it's actually pretty easy to recognize, right? So essentially, it'll be a person that will be like in a motor vehicle accident, right? And then they'll tell you that the person has subcutaneous emphysema. So I know some of you may be saying, oh, but Divine, couldn't this also be esophageal rupture? You're right, it could also be esophageal rupture, but the thing is, your friends on the MBME, esophageal rupture, they will typically give it in a person that has been retching very powerfully, or they will give it in a person that recently got some kind of upper endoscopy, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. So if you don't see that history, you see more of like a trauma incident, you want to think more about like injury to the bronchi or the trachea, right? So what are some classic things you'll see in a test question? They'll tell you that, oh, the person has like a Rice Krispie sensation of the skin, right? Or they may tell you that, oh, you see linear dark lines outlining the tracheobronchial tree. That's essentially the MBME describing pneumomediastinum to you on a test, right? So if you see that, right, you want to think about tracheobronchial injury. Another way they occasionally test this on exams is they will tell you about a person that has like, you'll think that they have like, let's say you're like, oh, decreased breath sounds and all that crap, right? But you're like, man, I've placed the chest tube like hours ago. This person does not appear to be getting better. Or they tell you that, oh, you see a persistent air leak, even in the presence of a chest tube. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about injury to the trachea or bronchi. They've probably ruptured or something, right? And again, like I said, the classic imaging finding is a pneumomediastinum. For the most part, I mean, you tend to, these people have to go to surgery pretty much, right? So for you to be able to fix their problem. And the thing is, the question, again, they may write it to look a lot like a pneumothorax question, but just some features of a pneumothorax won't be there, right? Like everything will be in the middle, so you won't have any kind of like mediastinal shift. You won't have any like JVD and stuff like that. If you see those things, I really want you to consider like rupture of the, like a traumatic rupture of the bronchus or traumatic rupture of the trachea under those circumstances. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient was in a high-speed motor vehicle collision? And this patient is, you know, kind of complaining of some chest pain. And, you know, they tell you that this patient gets fluids, right? So they may tell you that, oh, when the patient came into the hospital, patient didn't have crackles, nothing. Well, then you give the patient fluids and then, oh, everything gets really bad from there, right? So, and then they begin to give you like all these like cardiac numbers, right? So they give you like a pulmonary capillary wedge pressure that's elevated. They tell you that, oh, there are crackles on auscultation of the lungs. Or, oh, they tell you that the cardiac index is decreased, right? Basically, they may even have like a mild elevation in their troponins, believe it or not, right? But the big thing will be the temporal, because they may try to fool you on an MBME into picking an MI, right? But if you see a person that has a mildly, not super elevated troponin, mildly elevated troponin in the setting of like recent like motor vehicle trauma, you absolutely, absolutely, absolutely want to think about something called a myocardial contusion, right? Myocardial contusion on an MBME exam. And the thing is, when you see a myocardial contusion, again, they will have almost like a cardiogenic shock-like picture, right? So you may give those people fluids, and by giving them fluids, their status begins to worsen, right? You know, they become more hypoxic. You begin to hear crackles in the lungs. The CVP, the central venous pressure, which is a surrogate for right atrial pressure, goes up. The PCWP, the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which is a surrogate for left atrial pressure, goes up, right? If you see all those things, you absolutely want to think about a myocardial contusion on an MBME exam. They typically won't go into details of managing it or whatever. That's about where they stop on these tests, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient, similar issue, you know, high-speed motor vehicle collision, but now this person is complaining of like shortness of breath, and then they may give you like all these ABG labs, right? And you notice that, oh, this person's oxygen tension in the blood, like PaO2 is low, right? So P little AO2 is low. And they may give you like, you know, that PCO2 is mildly elevated, or it may actually be decreased. So that number is a little less reliable. And then they tell you that, oh, on chest x-ray, they see like, they see, what is this thing called? They see all these infiltrates, like these interstitial infiltrates. So you can see like a lung that is almost like white. Whenever you see those kinds of things, think about a pulmonary contusion, okay? So they won't have many cardiac maladies going on the test. They'll have a they'll have mostly pulmonary things, right? So like they'll have hypoxia. They'll have like white out lung, right? Like a partially white out lung. It's not like terrible ARDS style white out lung. If you see those kinds of things, you absolutely want to think about pulmonary contusion on an MBM exam, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient was in, again, high-speed motor vehicle collision. And then this patient, they tell you that this patient has like very severe like pain with very severe pain with whenever they take a deep breath, and they show you some labs, and again you see signs of hypoxia, you see this person is building up their CO2, so their PCO2 is high. So in this case, their PCO2 is almost always high on a test, right? And then they tell you that, oh, that you can feel like some crepitus on palpation of the chest, right? And then they tell you that, oh, when the person inhales, you notice that the ribs move inward with inspiration and outward with expiration. Whenever you see stuff like that, you want to think about a person that's potentially fractured their ribs, right? And if you want to get a little more specific there, those people have something known as flail chest, okay? Those people have something known as flail chest. Basically, they fractured multiple ribs, right? And when you fracture multiple ribs, you begin to have like paradoxical chest wall motion, because usually your ribs should move outward with inspiration and inward with expiration. Whenever you see paradoxical movement of the ribs, right, where a person's ribs move inward with inspiration, you see the ins kind of match, or outward, right, or externally with expiration. Let me see if I can match it up there. Then you absolutely want to think about flail chest on your exam, right? Those are classic findings. And really, you may say, Divine, all these chest injuries you're talking about, like how do we what's your initial diagnostic step? Just get a chest x-ray for the most part and you should be fine, right? So the thing is, there are some intricacies that your friends at the MBME love to test with these things, right? So the thing is, for the most part, when people fracture their ribs, they'll be fine, right? But they're dealing with a lot of pain and you need to make sure that they are ventilating appropriately, right? Because one thing that they may say on an MBME exam, they may say, which of the following best represents the most likely complication, like the most likely short-term complication of this person's problem, right? Under the circumstances of the MBME, you absolutely want to think something more along the lines of like atelectasis, right? Because the thing is, when a person has like a rib fractures or flail chest, because it hurts a ton to breathe, right, they will not be taking very good breaths in, right? And if they're not taking good breaths in, then their lungs are more prone to collapsing, right? So they can get atelectasis. And the thing is, again, if you're not moving air really well, you're not moving sections of the lung really well, then bacteria can begin to have a field day in that region of lung, right? And essentially the person can get a pneumonia with that, right? So those are things you absolutely want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And remember that they can even give you a question about a person that has a rib fracture, and then they tell you that, oh, this person, you know, is like super hypoxic, complaining of shortness of breath. And then they tell you that on auscultation of the chest, you hear unilaterally decreased breath sounds. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about a pneumothorax under those circumstances. That's also one of the complications of having like a rib fracture, right? And the thing is, typically when people have rib fractures, one unique answer you may want to see on an MBME is typically for those people, if you can do some kind of nerve block, right? If you can do like some kind of chest wall nerve block, like a thoracic nerve block, typically those people tend to do pretty well, because essentially it will just help them breathe, and then over time they will just recover, right? So that's one thing that's beginning to be done more commonly in hospitals, to be honest with you. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient was in a high-speed motor vehicle collision, and then they tell you that, oh, on imaging of the chest, like a chest x-ray, you notice that this person has like a widened mediastinum, right? A widened mediastinum. If you see that, that's kind of bad news right there, right? So this person has essentially ruptured the great vessel, right? The aorta, essentially, right? And again, you'll almost kind of present like an aortic dissection picture. You see like widened mediastinum, but you'll see the temporal association with recent trauma. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about some kind of traumatic aortic rupture, right? And the thing is, management of these patients is pretty easy. For the most part, they're going to go to surgery, right? But the thing is, if they are hemodynamically unstable, you perform a TEE, not a transthoracic, a transesophageal echocardiogram. You do a TEE, and then you wheel them over to surgery, right? But if they are hemodynamically stable, right, you can do like a CT scan, right? You can do like CT, like a CT scan of the chest, or you can do like a CT angiogram of the chest, right? You will see the region of traumatic rupture, and then those people, you go ahead and wheel them to surgery. I mean, aortic rupture is like bad news, right? Because the thing is, and if your aorta ruptures, where's the blood supply to your body going to come from? It's not, usually those people don't do very well. I mean, the vast majority of them die or become brain dead, right? And the thing is, in general, when a person has an aortic rupture, the thing that usually causes the transection is usually the ligamentum arteriosum. It just kind of just slices through, like a clean slice through the aorta, and then it's entirely transected. And it's usually like the beginnings of the descending aorta that people tend to get those kinds of squibbles. So you definitely, again, want to make sure you know that stuff for purposes of your exam, right? And then if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, had like some kind of, I don't know, like neck trauma or something like that, right? And then they tell you that this person is having like shortness of breath, and that you notice that you can hear breath sounds on one side of the chest, but you cannot hear breath sounds on the other side of the chest. And then they may show you like a big, like a chest x-ray, and you may see like one hemidiaphragm that is vastly elevated compared to the other. If you see that, what do you want to think about on an exam? I would really hope you're thinking that this person has injured the phrenic nerve, right? So remember on MBME exams, I mean, you probably remember this from like studying for anatomy for step one, this whole business with like C3, 4, 5 keeps the diaphragm alive, right? So if for whatever reason you have like cervical injury or neck injury, and then you transect the phrenic nerve, the diaphragm on that side will be paralyzed. And it's actually the paralyzed diaphragm that will be elevated, right? The paralyzed diaphragm will elevate, right? So if you see like a unilaterally elevated diaphragm in a person with shortness of breath with a normal AA gradient, you absolutely want to think about, you absolutely want to think about like a phrenic nerve, like injury under those circumstances. And, you know, typically for those people, you need to go ahead and intubate them, and then you kind of go from there. But the thing is, going from there, that's beyond the scope of many of these MBME exams. If you're a resident, I can go over that stuff with you, but not for purposes of a med student. So I'm going to go ahead and skip that. And again, key thing to keep in mind, because they can make this very easily a respiratory physiology question. The person will have hypoxia, but you'll have a normal AA gradient. Remember, your AA gradient will typically be normal in the setting of hypoxia if you have a non-pulmonary cause of the hypoxia, right? So if, for example, you have like an extra pulmonary problem, right, that will cause a normal AA gradient. Compare that with something like ARDS, right? ARDS, remember, it's a very common complication of like drowning, right? Or being like in a house fire, right? So those people, right, their lungs are wet with fluid, right? They have like a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema with the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure being less than 18, right? Whenever you see that, you know, ARDS, increased vascular permeability, those people, because their lungs actually have a problem, those people will be hypoxemic, but that hypoxemia will be accompanied by an increased AA gradient. That's a very high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then one other thing you may see on a test, right, is they may give you a question about a person that has, like a common question that pops up on these MBMEs is, if a person is in abdominal trauma, who goes to for XLAP immediately? This one is actually pretty easy to answer. Essentially, if you have any kind of penetrating injury to the abdomen, right, so let's say stab wound, gunshot wound, those people are getting exploratory laparotomy like instantly, right? Another common one you may see on a test is if a person has like free air under the diaphragm, right? If a person has free air under the diaphragm, that's bad news, right? Those people, that means they've perforated some part of the abdomen. They have like some kind of perforated viscous, right? So if they have that perforated viscous, again, those people don't pass go, they don't collect $200. If you can't tell, by the way, I really love Monopoly. You go ahead and wheel those people over to surgery, right? And then another classic one you may see on tests is if a person has signs of peritonitis, right? So let's say they tell you that they have like a rigid abdomen, they have rebound, they have guarding. Whenever you see that, you know, you go ahead and wheel those people to surgery, right? Those people, you don't get any kind of diagnostic testing. You just go ahead and proceed straight to the operating room, right? And the thing is, in general, so that's the penetrating trauma algorithm for the abdomen, and that's pretty much all you need to do there. The thing is, if a person has blunt trauma to the abdomen, right, the first question you need to ask yourself is this patient hemodynamically stable or hemodynamically unstable? I'll say that again. If a person has blunt abdominal trauma, you need to ask yourself, are they hemodynamically stable or hemodynamically unstable? If the patient is hemodynamically stable, then your next step in diagnosis on the exam is to just go ahead and, you know, get those people like a CT scan of the abdomen, right, with contrast. You get a CT scan of the abdomen with contrast, you'll see whatever badness is going on, and then you manage as needed, right? But if the patient is hemodynamically unstable, your first step in diagnosis on an MBM exam is to proceed to obtaining a fast scan. A fast scan is essentially an ultrasound of some recesses in the abdomen. I'll encourage you to watch a video on this. You know, some recesses in the abdomen, you're trying to look for blood. Obviously, if you see blood, then XLAP is your next best step in management. And the thing is, your friends at the MBME, sometimes they may not write exploratory laparotomy. They may write exploratory ciliotomy. Exploratory ciliotomy is essentially the same thing as, it's just a $5 word for exploratory laparotomy. Essentially, the thing that happens is, instead of saying laparotomy, right? Because think about it. What is the main artery that supplies many of the foregut organs that tend to be involved in abdominal injury? It's the celiac artery, right? So it would make sense that they call that an exploratory ciliotomy on an MBM exam. So that's something you absolutely want to keep at the back of your mind for tests, right? So, like I said, blunt force trauma to the abdomen, first diagnostic step, fast scan, right? If the fast scan does not show you what, if it's negative, right, your next step will be a DPL, a diagnostic peritoneal lavage, right? If the diagnostic peritoneal lavage is negative, then the next thing you go to is to perform a CT scan of the abdomen, right? So again, let me reel it out from beginning to end. Fast scan first, that's number one. Number two, so if fast scan is negative, you proceed to a diagnostic peritoneal lavage. If the DPL is negative, then you proceed to to a CT scan of the abdomen. I mean, that algorithm doesn't really make sense to me. It will make sense to just get the CT scan and that you can get in like, you know, like 30 seconds, but you know, that's the MBME. They're the ones that determine your grade, so you got to go with what they mention, right? So that's how you manage blunt force trauma to the abdomen. And obviously, if any of those things are ever positive, then your next step in management is going to be exploratory laparotomy, right? That's something you absolutely want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, you know, it's like a boy, and this boy was, you know, riding his bicycle and then he fell, and then he's been complaining of like sudden onset severe abdominal pain. And then they give you like a lipase and an amylase that's super elevated. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about traumatic pancreatitis, right? Traumatic pancreatitis. For those, you generally don't need to make any kind of imaging diagnosis. Although routinely people try to get like some kind of imaging of the abdomen just to make sure that this child did not rupture some kind of vessel, right? But remember, like your classic, you probably remember this studying for step one, handlebar injuries. They are very commonly implicated in people that end up getting like pancreatitis, right? So especially in kids, kids are the ones you want to look out for on exams, right? So you see that, you know, you think about pancreatitis, the lipase will be elevated. They will have the classic symptoms. If they have like the classic symptoms, you don't really need to do any kind of imaging. Those people, you essentially make them NPO. You give them pain control, right? And you give them IV fluids, right? And that's it. And remember that pancreatitis, there are some things that are very bad prognostic indicators, right? So let's say, for example, your BUN rises by a lot, right? Or I will encourage you to look up the Ranson's criteria. I'm kind of speeding through this here because I got to go in like 5 minutes, but I want to make sure I cover all, like all the chest and abdomen trauma in this one podcast. So basically, you know, NPO, IV fluids, pain control, right? But again, like I said, if your calcium is really low, that's bad in pancreatitis. That's a bad prognostic sign. If your white count is really high, or if your hematocrit drops by a lot, or if your BUN rises by a lot, or if your LDH rises by a lot, those are all bad prognostic indicators. But a common one on MBMs is the calcium. If your calcium is really low in pancreatitis, you need to maybe, you know, kind of keep your eyes peeled on that patient. They may not do very well in the hospital, unfortunately, right? And then another question you may see on a test that involves kids is, let me give you a question about a kid again, maybe in a motor vehicle accident, and this kid has been complaining of abdominal pain, and then they give you a hemoglobin that is low, right? And the patient, you know, keeps clutching his abdomen, blah 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 blah, hemodynamically unstable, hypotensive, hemoglobin low. If you see that, you want to think about a duodenal hematoma, okay, or duodenal rupture as the child's complaint, essentially, as a diagnosis. Basically, that child has impacted the gastroduodenal artery, right? So those people, your next step in management on an MBME exam is to go ahead and get like angiography with embolization, right? So that they don't bleed out and die. GDA bleeds are very deadly, I have like real world experience. GDA bleeds are super, super, super deadly, right? So it's just one of those things you don't really mess around with. And one thing that they may give you on an MDME exam is they may give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that, oh, this patient was in trauma and this patient is having like right shoulder pain. If you see that, you know, the person's spleen has ruptured essentially, right? That's something that's known as Kerr sign, right? K-E-H-R, right? Kerr sign. Essentially, the thing that has happened is because the spleen has ruptured, it's irritating the diaphragm, right? So the phrenic nerve is like getting some like weird signals, right? And because the phrenic nerve, some fibers from C3-4-5 actually supply the upper extremity. I mean, think about your brachial plexus, C5 to T1, right? Then those people get like referred shoulder pain. I mean, in general, if a person has like a blunt force trauma to the abdomen, the liver and the spleen are usually like the big things that tend to be implicated as injured under those circumstances. And then another high yield thing I think I want to discuss is like GI bleeds, right? GI bleeds, you know, essentially these things are very simple, but people get them wrong all the time on exams. I don't know why. I mean, honestly, I really don't know. But the thing is, if a person has a GI bleed, your first step in management is one, you place two peripheral IVs, right? Two large bore IVs, you give fluids plus or minus blood first. That's always what you do first. They will put EGD as an answer, but it will be wrong. If you've not started giving fluids, you need to give fluids plus or minus blood before you proceed, right? And then after you do that, right, the next thing you do essentially is you go ahead and do an EGD first, right? You do an EGD first. You do upper endoscopy and esophageal gastroduodenoscopy. If that's negative, then your next step is to do a colonoscopy, right? If the colonoscopy is negative, then, you know, you start doing like the exotic stuff, like you can do like angiography, you can do like a tagged red blood cell scan and all that fun stuff. But that's essentially how you manage GI bleeds. And, you know, people that have GI bleeds, you need to give them IV proton pump inhibitors, right? You know, to kind of help them there. You need to give them, you can give them like IV octreotide as well, right? So that they don't get like peptic ulcer disease, right? They don't get like an ulcer in those settings. So I think those are kind of like the big things I'm going to talk about here. I'm just trying to think, is there any other high yield thing I've not really mentioned? I think I've talked about many of the big things. Yeah, many of like the, you know, like chest and abdominal wall stuff and the GI bleed stuff. So this podcast, I promise you, if you're taking your surgery shelf or your EMED shelf or step 2 CK, you'll very likely get like 10, like on the shelf, maybe like 5 to 7 questions right. On step 2 CK, you probably get like 10 to 15 questions right from just this one, like 23-ish minute podcast. So I'll strongly encourage you to pay attention to this. Sorry, I can't really talk about a life lesson today. I kind of need to go. But again, as I do at the end of every podcast, alpha tutoring for many exams, step 1, 2 CK, 2 CS, step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine or a peds resident, I tutor for the in-training exam and the board exams for those. I tutor for all the pre-med, like MCAT subjects. And I do these booster courses for step 1, 2 CK, and step 3. They are 20 hours each. Again, it's like the most knows, the highest of the high yields. I've done this with tons of people, and all the people I've done it with, they found it to be like super, super helpful for the tests. So if that's something you're interested in, just reach out to me either through the website or send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And please subscribe to the YouTube channel, subscribe to the podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and what's this other thing called? Google Play. And you can also subscribe to my WordPress website. So thank you for listening. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.